This podcast is part of the Gun and Geek Network. The opinions expressed may not reflect those of other podcasts or affiliates of the show or Gun and Geek. Check out other geeky podcasts at gunandgeeknetwork.com. Get ready because geekiness commences in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, the podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Whitten.
I prefer to jazzercise my demons, but yeah. And my co-host, Haley Malley.
That line you're worrying about crossing. Look behind you.
And Keir Hansen.
Gallifrey Public Radio. Now we have maths.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But if we get into anything too serious, don't worry. We'll warn you again. Welcome to episode 98 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we take some time to discuss a group of individuals who bear some of the greatest responsibilities in the universe, whose daily decisions shape and maintain the very fabric of space and time. But that doesn't excuse them for acting like a bunch of twats. I'm Jay, and with me this week in the GPR studios is Keir. How's it going, Keir?
Outstanding. How are you, sir?
Doing great. And Haley, how are you doing, ma'am?
I'm also great.
Awesome.
There's a lot of greatness going on here. Man. So this week, I have to be reminded by the immortal words, the ongoing words of the legendary Stan Lee when he reminds us so often that with great power comes great responsibility. If you have a degree of power that allows you to actually change the paths of history on a universal scale, then you're dealing with a corresponding responsibility that is also of epic proportions. So you have to hope that those individuals at the controls have a degree of benevolence to them. So this week, we decided that with everything that had been going on in the Whoniverse lately and everything that we have, that we're wondering about and hoping for or expecting from the season to come, we wanted to take a look at these select few of the Gallifreyan culture who have been deemed and to a certain degree physically altered to be called Time Lords. And in doing so, really determine whether or not using the term benevolent even fits. So, I mean, the Doctor that we care about so much is one of them, so how bad can they really be, Can you get down to it?
Yeah. No, that never ended badly.
No, of course not.
Judging a whole race on one individual? No.
And they're all such smiley, happy people when you see them with their giant collars.
Yeah. So, all right. Obviously, this is going to be a big deal coming back into Series 8. We've got the hunt for Gallifrey. We know that the planet is safe somewhere and that the Time Lords still exist. And, it's going to be a recurring theme that we're going to get now. They're not all dead anymore, so we better bone up on this. So what do we know about the Time Lords?
Well, it was an interesting thing. We had one quick statement from Bobby Honeycutt, who we love hearing from. Thank you so much for everything that he chimes in on. That he didn't even realize, and he's a pretty diehard Whovian, both classic and new, and didn't really have a distinction that there was a difference between your typical Gallifreyan and a Time Lord to begin with.
Right.
But just bear in mind, this from Sound of the Drums and some of the interactions with the Master, with Tenth Doctor and things. We learned about some of the originating culture, and a lot of this has been taken off in the novels as well, that there's the whole idea of the collegiate system, the Gallifreyan collegiate program that takes children at the age of 8 or so and starts to condition them and rank them to see whether or not they have what it takes to be deemed Time Lords. So there is a distinction between your standard Gallifreyan layperson and the Time Lords themselves as a subset of that. So,
do they ever go into any discussion of like what percentage are Time Lords versus Gallifreyans?
I never really saw anything regarding numbers, but other than the fact that similarly to any sort of a military academy or anything like that, the dropout rate was considerably high because one of the aspects, as we know from what we learned just from what the Master went through. And the Doctor himself, that they part of the process of preparing them or changing them, altering them to be able to handle the regenerative process and everything else that goes along with the knowledge of past, present, future, is the exposure to the Great Schism, which when you stare into the actual vortex of time itself, unfiltered, it's either going to, you know, open up and unlock the chakras in your mind, so to speak, or you'll go running off for the hills, or it'll drive you back guano insane.
Yeah.
Or maybe a little bit of all three.
Here, no, you're going to go look into this hole, and you're either going to turn into a god, or you're going to go nuts. Yeah. Sound good? All right. Sounds like a deal to me.
So I got to imagine that the selection process or the cutoff rate is pretty strong. So otherwise it wouldn't be quite as the Time Lords have always been described as very much about pomp and circumstance. Everything is very very ceremonial, from their ranks to their practices, to their speech, to the fact that they refer to everything as the this of so-and-so and the that of such-and-such, for no other reason because of the fact that it sounds regal. So they are constantly being, you know, stabbed at as being, you know, pretentious and self-aggrandizing and so forth. So that leads me to believe that they are a pretty small subset of the overall Gallifreyan populace.
So we know that they're the ones that actually get to rule. They're the ones that control time and or can time travel and all of that stuff. So what? I mean, we know that they're basically the head of Gallifrey. Let's say, we understand that they're the ones that actually have the regeneration capability. So a typical Gallifreyan does not have regenerations. This is something that isn't built into their physiology. This is something that is bestowed upon them when they get the title of Time Lord or Time Lady.
Well, the Gallifreyans in and of themselves have a particularly long life cycle, but Time Lords obviously have the ability to extend that farther because of their regenerative processes. So there are some Time Lords that have been credited as living, you know, tens of thousands of years. So we're talking the ability of really being able to take on a near godlike status. And again, going back to that original comment about the power and the responsibility, there's also the standard adage that absolute power corrupts absolutely. So there's always a very fine line that's being walked. And this is actually something that has been addressed in the show on numerous occasions. Almost always, I mean, from its earliest inceptions, it was typically between... we knew the First Doctor had rebelled against it, but he really didn't discuss it much because it hadn't really been incorporated much into the show. Mm-hmm. Second Doctor, you understand the fact that, you know, now that we understand what his species is. We never even had a name for his home planet until Third Doctor. By the time you get to Fourth Doctor, we're really starting to butt heads with him on a regular basis, and we start to get a lot more of an understanding as to how rebellious the Doctor really is against the status quo on his home planet. And it really, some of the things that the Fourth Doctor brings into the mix shed a lot of light on the fact that the Time Lords' socio-political structure and the fact that they within the show, their responsibilities had kind of gone back and forth from being these sort of hands-off observers that really didn't want to have anything to do with anything. They were really just sort of cataloging and being these sort of, you know, these kind of chaplains to speak to, but they wouldn't interfere. Obviously, it feels very, you know, Trek Prime Directive sort of non-interference policies and such. But they wouldn't even think about violating the laws that they themselves had put forth about the idea of, you know, destiny is written, future cannot be altered, blah, 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 blah. Well, we realize really early on, I mean, by the time you get to Genesis of the Daleks, they're already starting to muck around with the timeline.
Yeah.
To massive scales and damn the repercussions. So that you recognize that there's at least a subset of these very powerful individuals who are willing to throw their own rules aside because of what they now deem to be the greater good. So, you know, who they have no power check. Mm-hmm. There is no check and balance system that really keeps the Time Lords in check as far as rules and regulations. So the only thing that really keeps them from you know, you get some of the, and we'll talk about some of the ones that have sort of broken off from the norm because they wanted to go on more of a conquest kind of a bend. But the only thing that really keeps that from happening is every once in a while, a war crops up with an extremely strong species that kind of knocks them down or sets them back a little bit in their plans, whether it be the Daleks, whether it be, you know, the vampires that we hear about from the, you know, millennia-year-old wars that they had dealt with. So if those sort of things didn't happen, I could very easily see the Time Lords descending into the very self-serving, I don't even know what the right term is, but exactly what the Doctor had been pushing against and accusing them of at all the times when they were trying to manipulate him to use him either by the CIA. I love the fact they use the CIA acronym. That kills me. But the celestial, not interference. What the hell?
Intervention.
Intervention. Yes. Interference really is the end of it all. Yeah, the celestial intervention agency. And they kept pushing the Doctor out to be the enforcement arm of it because he was the only one crazy enough to go out and do half the crap that they were too chicken to do, but they knew they wanted done anyway.
Yeah. But I mean, that's, you know, you started the show out talking about, you know, power and responsibility, and that obviously the only more prominent power quote that you can think of is, you know, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And that's basically what you get is you get these Time Lords that have control of time. They can do all of this stuff and they have unlimited power. And so over time, they do become corrupt. They do start to think, well, I know better. I know how to do this. And, you know, it's very much the Time Lord Victorious that we saw with the 10th Doctor. Sure. It's, you know, I have this power. Why shouldn't I put my will forward? Because obviously I know better and that kind of thing. And then, like you said, you know, you get a war or you get something happening or you get one Time Lord with a conscience who stands up and smacks them all down and be like, no, this is not who we are. So it's, you have those moments where something beyond their control happens to keep them in check. But you're right. There's nothing built into the system. It's just kind of like, oh, well, we'll get big and powerful. And if we get too powerful, something will come along and take care of it for us. You know, but. So let's take a look at some of the individual Time Lords that we've got. I mean, we run the gamut. We've got, you know, everyone from the Doctor to the Master to, you know, Rassilon. I mean, there's all these guys. Where do they fall on, like, say, the spectrum of good versus evil?
It's not easy to kind of say that the good versus the bad stem from any one particular sect. Mm-hmm. Because while there is a sort of a classification or a sort of a party system within the Time Lord political structure, they have they don't call them families. They don't really call them even classes or anything of that sort. But you end up with these call them houses that each of them fall into, with these chapters,
like Gryffindor and Slytherin.
Exactly, but the only indication that we really had of how that really broke out, because it had nothing to do with what their role or responsibility was, whether they were part of the High Council or not, whether they were some part of some other ministry within the governmental structure, but it was just the fact that they—I don't know if it had something to do with their geographical origin or something of that sort. Maybe that's been explained in one of the novels that I'm not familiar with. But the one that you keep hearing come up every once in a while is the Prydonians, because that happened to be the chapter of the Time Lords that produced, you know, as far as the collegiate system, that produced the Doctor himself, but as well as the Master and the Rani, so who are all considered to be the fringe of what was even deemed acceptable. So they were all subject to potential exile. Doctor just happened to run before he was exiled, but I'm sure he was right along the path to getting that done with all the trouble he was making.
You can't fire me, I quit.
That's it, mic drop.
Screw you, screw you, screw you. You're cool, screw you, I'm out.
Exactly. But that leads me to one of my basic questions here. I mean, we're talking about where we're going into with Capaldi's Doctor right now, and the fact that everybody loves that from the wardrobe down to his behavior to everything that they're describing about what we're expecting for the series to come, they keep using this term, the 100% rebel Time Lord. Rah! You know, his punk rock, you know, eat it, kind of, you know, Sex Pistols Doctor kind of thing. But what is he really rebelling against? Because after it's all said and done, the underpinnings of what the Time Lords were instituted to maintain, isn't that really what he does and they fail to do? You know, they've kind of lost their direction and he's the only one that's really staying on the path in some sort of a benevolent sense.
Well, I mean, couldn't that be kind of where he's going now in the fact that, like, he sees them coming back and, you know, and it begins to process in his head saying, okay, I understand how they messed everything up. I mean, look at what they forced me to do to get them out of the way to save the universe and all this stuff. And he's like, no, they're not going to come back and start controlling things. That's my job. I am the time cop here. And it could be him fighting against them and doing what is best for reality.
That flip, I think, is one of the things that makes the that has made the headbutts between the Doctor and the Time Lords, as we've seen them in Classic Who, such a great aspect of the classic program. When we thought they were gone in New Who, or at least time locked, and that there was no point of access to them, the references to them were sort of a little more reverent. You know, Ninth Doctor spoke of them sort of, you know, as if they were gone.
Yeah.
So everything was sort of done, and this is sort of this melancholy look back. Then we meet Rassilon, and he's a dick. He's not even credited as Rassilon in the episode. I mean, we come to find out from RTD after the fact that really, you know, that Rassilon was actually the one being portrayed in the episode. But it just comes to realize, you know, as we find out that, because we had known from Classic Who that Omega and Rassilon, as the founders of Time Lord capabilities in terms of developing the technology that gave them temporal skills in the first place, had both been driven mad with power.
Right.
Rassilon was assumed to be dead. Omega was assumed, well, first, Omega was assumed to be dead.
Then he was dead. Then he was almost dead. Then he was kind of dead. Then he was
he
back.
Kinda backed up through the whole dead thing. Yeah. And Rassilon, we still, to this point, do not know exactly what his status is with regards to the time lock, because now both he and the Master are in this sort of a did he or didn't he kind of state. Mm-hmm. So the door is still open for either one of them, as far as canon stands.
Right.
No definitive answer, because a definitive answer in Who would just be boring.
Right. So,
but as far as other Time Lords that sort of sit on the good side of the fence, you definitely have to include Romana in that list. We had good interaction with her as a Time Lady, you know, intellectual equal with the Doctor, a running buddy for a while. And as far as the extended materials, she went on to become the president of the High Council, which under their structure is kind of it's not really a figurehead position, because she does have the ability to issue executive orders. The High Council has to be unanimous, though, to be able to overthrow them. But there's also a chancellor in their political structure who is actually the administrative arm. So the president is really just their is responsible for maintaining a lot of the objects of power, you know, the jock strap of Rassilon, the, you know, the contact lens case of Omega, and all those good things.
Right.
So you've got that check and balance system there. But Romana was able to, as far as it stands right now, I think if you were to follow canon to what last couple things that have been written, she's still considered to be the president, but she's the president of the Time Lord High Council in a parallel universe now. So when you get tired with a certain timeline, push it over into a parallel or a pocket universe, let it go.
All right.
And then there's Jenny. And I'm going to kick this over to you guys, because I still don't know what to think about Jenny.
I think Jenny is you can't really lump her in with the Time Lords, because she's something altogether different. She's not, you know, she's not of Gallifrey. She's not part of that society. It's basically just her physiology is similar, and that's about it. Okay. Yeah, it's I mean, yes, it would be very easy to say, oh, no, she's a time lady and there's this, that, and the other. But when it boils down to it, the only tie she has to any of that is the fact that she's basically a clone of the Doctor, and that's it. Like, she doesn't know anything about their society, nothing. So.
But as you speak about her in a physical sense, she is a clone of the Doctor in his post-modified state. So after he has already taken on all the physiology of a Time Lord, how that differentiates from your standard Gallifreyan. So she does have regenerative capabilities and all the things that go along with being a full Time Lady.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, she's kind of on that side of the Venn diagram.
Yeah. I don't know. It's, you know, if I thought for a second that she might actually come back to the show at some point, I'd be tempted to take the conversation further. But I highly doubt that that's actually going to happen as much as I might want it to.
Right.
But yeah, I don't see it happening. So, eh.
Okay.
It might be more interesting now that we've got a Doctor that's actually old enough to be her father.
Right. And not actually married to her.
Creepy.
No, but you know, when you talked about the difference, the way that they treated them differently with the Ninth Doctor and moving forward, you know, it reminds me of this this image that I'd seen before, and it was, you know, how New Whovians think of the Time Lords, and it's, you know, it's a picture of Gandalf and Dumbledore fighting, you know, going at just this huge wizard's duel and whatnot, and these great powerful beings, and then underneath it, it said, you know, how classic Whovians see the Time Lords, and it's these bunch of old guys sitting around a table, and now we will discuss the penchant of Rassilon for the unthing of Rassilon, and this whole, like, you know, collegiate kind of thing. It's like, and I mean, that's really the difference, is you see the Time Lords from Classic Who as, you know, Congress, basically.
Yeah, they're just Parliament.
Yeah.
That's exactly what it, and very little getting accomplished, a lot of people harumphing.
Yeah, and when you take them out of the picture and say, okay, we're only going to remember them instead of actually see them, then they become this mystical force and these, you know, these crazy godlike creatures that, you know, they create such a great mythos. And, I mean, that's kind of where we've talked about this before, but, you know, you have to wonder, is that all going to get pulled away? Are they going to be able to find that balance moving forward? But
yeah, I think we've only seen them twice so far in the New Who.
Yeah, we saw the presidential council, basically, mm-hmm. and then we saw the war council.
Yeah, and that's it for actually seeing them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm not entirely certain that the war council is actually comprised of Time Lords. The war council may be just Gallifreyan military. So that distinction, I mean, feel free, I'll put this out to the hive mind to try and do a little research on. But there's no indication necessarily that the that your war council has to be regenerative or you know full Time Lords in that regard, because they're grunts, they're apes. So I'd be interested to know whether or not that's actually going to be the whether they're actually comprised, whether that's necessary. Whereas the High Council, though, you know, since they deem themselves responsible for seeing everything on the longest scale possible. That's obviously comprised of the cream of the crop.
Right. All right. So we've talked about some of the ones that we would consider the better ones on the, you know, they're the lawful neutral, so to speak. which ones fall on the bottom of the grid? Which ones are we looking at as being, you know, for lack of a better term, evil?
Well, we did mention the Rassilon and Omega pairing.
Right,
you know, as the founders, you know, your Romulus and Remus, so to speak.
Yeah, you either die a hero or live long enough to see yourself turn into these guys.
Precisely. Yeah. And along with that, I would probably make sure that you mention another one who was, you know, grand name back in the day. Everyone thought he was gone, wasn't quite gone. Tried to come back, got defeated again. Was Morbius.
That could go for most of them at the.
Well, that's true. You know, never. He's only mostly dead. But Morbius was, you know, in terms of a high position of power within the council, but had these aspirations of seeing not just necessarily personal, but wanted to see the Gallifreyan society, wanted to see the Time Lord race or species be of a in a position of power on a galactic or universal scale through military conquest, because they obviously had the ability to ensure victory at every step of the game. But in direct obvious violation of some of their laws of time, he was exiled, and when he still wouldn't stay quiet, they attempted to have him executed. He was almost completely killed, but they were able to, his followers, of which he had a considerable number of them because of his argument, and like I said, any good villain has a compelling argument. His followers attempted to reconstitute him from a sliver of his brain.
Why freeze dried Time Lord.
Yeah, I only need a little bit of brain, Abby normal.
Well, I mean, so, we saw the Master do the same kind of thing in, what was it, The End of Time?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, you basically, they got his DNA off of his wife's lips, you know, months and months after the fact, and, well, okay.
It's science. Sure. It works out.
Yeah. Don't question
I miss
it.
Him so much, I never washed my face after our last kiss.
Even though I shot him and hated him.
We found his hairbrush.
We found his neighbor's hairbrush.
Yeah.
But yes, so the Master is another one of those cases. There's a conflicting story, though, as far as what you want to credit the Master's downfall. If you were to take one side of it, you'd say that he was, you know, it was a matter of looking into the ultimate schism that drove him mad, and from there he sort of descended into the darkness that consumed him. His drive in terms of what his goals were as a result of Classic Who are a little muddy, in terms of knowing what he was really after, or whether it was just straight insanity and he was just living for the sake of creating chaos. But regardless, you know, you've got either the fact that you could blame it on his upbringing and the fact that he didn't respond well to the Time Lord hazing process. Or you could take the take with Sims Master, John Sims Master, that Rassilon really kind of drove him nuts by wanting to find a way out of the time lock and implanting the drum pattern into his head, which slowly drove him bonkers to the point where he could then use the entirety of the human race as a giant echo chamber and thus allow Rassilon to pop out of the time lock. So in either case, I guess, either directly or indirectly, the Time Lords are responsible for making the Master the nut job that he is, or was, or is. We don't know.
Or will be. Tenses are hard. Yeah. So, I mean, that, obviously the Master is the one that everybody thinks of when you think evil Time Lord. I mean, we've got more of them, though. I mean, what about the Monk?
I liked the Monk. I mean, because of the audiobooks, because of the novels and stuff. I mean, we really haven't had a lot of involvement with the Monk since First and Second Doctors. You know, he was also referred to as the Time Meddler because he was exactly that. As much as Morbius wanted military conquest, the Monk wanted personal gain. And the only reason why he's called a Monk is because the Doctor ended up exiling him in 15th century England and broke his TARDIS. He disabled the aspect of it that allowed it to stay bigger on the inside, you know, the spatial relationship modules and things. In the extended materials, he was able to fix that, and he crops up as being a troublemaker later on, but it was just a matter of you know, we catch him in, which was it? Jay, we recently covered this. Was it the Lucy Miller episodes?
No, it was Dark Eyes 2, wasn't it?
Okay, first Dark Eyes.
Was it first Dark Eyes? I thought it was the second one.
I think it was. But regardless, he's actually going around. The Daleks are about to completely eradicate the human race, and the Monk is going around collecting priceless works of art and history to preserve the human legacy. But he's
first Dark Eyes, because I remember it.
Okay.
And you love him. He's a perfect prick. Oh, yeah. He's just completely shameless. And even when he has things taken away from him, you know, he stamps his foot like a little child and everything. It's great. But we've run into a number of characters like him. We've also had, obviously, the Valyard, and other, you know, pompous windbags that represent the council, that but seem to be doing so strictly for the benefit of either self-aggrandizing or just being a thorn in the side of the doctor because he doesn't play by the rules that they hold so near and dear.
See, I've got to say that I actually love the boatyard. I think he's fantastic just because he's so completely, I don't give a crap. I just want to ruin this guy's day. He's a perfect villain. And he
What is his name?
The Valyard.
Oh, okay.
The junkyard.
The brickyard, the backyard, the boatyard. He's just a great villain, and you're basically invited to hate this guy with every fiber of your being because he has nothing redeemable about him. And it's every now and again, you need a villain like that where it's like, you know, I'm going to hate you and I don't care about anything. It's just, it makes for a great release sometimes.
Well, it's, I think that's what makes that particular episode where we get so much of the value, that being the trial of the Time Lord, makes it more enjoyable because then you have that and you've got this windbag that we're dealing with, but then they throw the Master into the mix as well.
Yeah.
And now you've got this triangle of people pointing at each other and just screaming at each other with Colin Baker at the time as the doctor. So you know you're going to get some great verbal spats going on in this thing. And it's just, it's brilliant to see the entire thing just dissolve in the middle of a court trial. So it's like a big Judge Judy thing gone horribly, horribly wrong. And the bailiff's just knocking people in the head. So... the Valyard is definitely a great one to throw in the mix as far as Time Lords we love to hate. The only one, I wouldn't say I put her on the hate list because it was just such an interesting thing to throw in, was the Rani. Didn't really get a fair shake in the episodes because they weren't really the best written at the time. But as far as the idea of this really clever, hyper-intelligent and motivated but just devious Time Lady, who was hell-bent on taking down the Time Lords as revenge for her exile, just kind of made a great storyline. I just wish it was a little better executed or was just given more time to work itself through.
Yeah, and I mean, that's one of the things is there have been a lot of people that have begged for the return of the Rani because she was a great villain. She was a compelling character. So yeah, it would be kind of fun to see her come back, but then, you know, Moffat has said it's not going to happen. He's not doing it. And she's a dangerous person to bring back because she is so dynamic and because she is one that people enjoyed so much. Mm-hmm. It's dangerous because it could be very easy to get it wrong. It's like taking a beloved movie trilogy from the 70s and trying to redo it, and it's just scary because you know that it might get messed up. I'm looking at you, Abrams. I'm looking at you.
Sorry. Oh, I thought you were looking at George Lucas.
Oh, no, he already did his damage. I'm you know, looking at the repair process. yeah, so it would be fun to see her come back, but again, you know, it's
not necessary.
Yeah.
Necessarily. I mean, the whole idea of there's plenty of places we can go with the story that don't require pulling everything back out of the way back machine. It had its opportunity. It served its purpose. There may be other characters. People keep saying, you know, it's time for the Master to come back. Well, bear in mind, there was a point where people were sick of seeing the Master appear in episodes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we've also talked about the fact that, you know, isn't there a certain degree of mystique in leaving a character unseen? Speaking about them but not seeing them gives them a certain degree of that cloudy, you know, that darkness to them, that, you know, we can refer to them in the third person and draw our own conclusions. But if you put them on screen, or put them on screen repeatedly, it takes all that away from us. So,
but we haven't seen him in what, 4 or 5 years?
Yeah. Yeah. But now the question is, yeah, you're going to have to figure out how to write him back in. What's going to be his motivation as far as every time he does return, his goal is something different. Typically, it's just the mustache twirling, getting the doctor's way. And by the end of the episode, he's in a busted ship spinning off into space again. Oh, curse you. I'll come back again.
Right.
So.
Well, I mean, okay, simple solution to that. One, you bring him back. You don't say anything about how he got there. He's just, boom, master's back, crap, deal with the issue. And, I mean, I know as someone that likes to focus on details, there's a moment there where I'm like, but how did this happen? Never mind, I'm enjoying myself. You know, it's, if you don't give any information, you don't need any, you know. But then I think it would be great to bring him back as like, okay, say the doctor finds Gallifrey and he's about to bring it back and the master panics and he's like, no, 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 leave them there. And then you have the two of them working against each other in that fashion.
Or, I'll build on that because I like where that's headed, something where there's the opportunity to bring Gallifrey back to in sync with the universe. Because mm-hmm. you know, right now we're, whatever, we're protecting them by keeping them just slightly left of center or whatever it is you know, that keeps them out of step. But it becomes a big verbal showdown between Doctor and Master that determine that it's in the best interests for them to remain isolated as they are.
Right.
So, you know, if I, either for reasons of the fact that things have broken down on a sociopolitical structure, you know, within Gallifrey since they've been enclosed within the time lock, they're now, you know, things have gone absolutely, you know, dystopian. And that bringing them back now could run the risk of tearing apart the laws that they were originally set in place to protect. So they become not necessarily a villain or an evil force, but a power that needs to be kept under control. So isolating them allows them to remain. You know, it's not a genocide or anything of that sort, but they're more... they're too much of a risk of harm to themselves and others if they are allowed to play with the rest of the class.
Okay. Yeah.
And it's the doctor that actually, because he's the one that's been stuck with them now for, you know, however much time has elapsed since he was actually pushed back with Rassilon into the time lock, that we come to find out that you know, he has to be the one to open the doctor's eyes to that.
That could be fun.
That could be interesting. That
could be interesting.
I'm ready to start writing for you, Mr. Moffat. I have a handful of ideas.
Oh, yeah. But
the problem is, most of them suck.
When we saw the Master last, he was like shooting lightning and jumping up really high and stuff. Is that something that happens with Time Lords when they get brought back from the dead?
We don't talk about that.
I don't know about the jumpy spider ability, the fact that he can, you know, leap tall buildings and things of that sort. Yeah. I have not seen many instances. You take the Master when he, the last time he was starting to break down, and he was basically a California raisin.
Yeah.
He was this little shriveled up thing that looked like Mr. Hankey and was of no threat to anybody in the whole, you know, Keeper of Trocken kind of period. This time around, they're really starting to toy around with what happens when a Time Lord in their final throes starts tapping into additional power resources. You know, they made the mistake in 96 when they said, okay, they're going to give him the ability to travel around in some of his raw forms as a silver floaty CGI snake. So I think they were still, especially in RTD, they were kind of playing around with how they were going to make him more menacing as he was getting to the point of being able to amass this greater power. That is definitely not indicative of anything we've seen prior. I think they just gave it to him because he sort of plays outside the box.
Yeah.
And he's gone through such great lengths to modify, manipulate, extend his life to amass greater power beyond what a Time Lord is originally instilled with, that there may be other factors playing along.
Yeah, and then you've got the argument that you could say, oh, well, it was just because of whatever it was that the wife threw in there that messed up the whole, you know, resurrection process, that's what gave him those powers, or that's what enabled him to do it. It's, there's all kinds of ways that you can hand wave it. Mm. So,
I'm gonna throw one more in. As we were talking about Time Lords on either side of the fence, what do you want to do with River?
That's a good question.
Regeneration, yes. Fairly adept control over temporal placement. Hops around time without any real issue. Seems to get the gist of it.
Yeah. I want to say she falls under the same category as Jenny, but one, we do see her more than just once, and we see her capability at a lot more than just, you know, pre-programmed combat and regeneration. So,
yeah, she was essentially a mutated human.
Yeah, basically.
Really comes down to it.
Because, I mean, Vastra says it herself. She says, you know, she's Time Lord plus, or, you know, human plus. Mm. So it's, that's basically what it boils down to. But yes, yeah, she does carry a lot of Time Lord characteristics.
Okay.
Yep.
I'd say that, yeah, we can throw her in as a Time Lady with a caveat.
An asterisk.
Yeah. Yeah. Time Lady. Okay,
I have a question about Time Lords in general. Can they recognize someone as the same person after a regeneration?
They say that they can recognize Time Lords, specifically. Like, there's actually a quote from the Doctor that when he's seeking out the Master, and he says, I'll know a Time Lord when I see him. Mm-hmm. But whether or not you could say, you know, and I think there have been some instances where the Doctor, upon his regenerations, comes into contact with other Time Lords, and they understand. I don't know whether there's, you know, prompting that gives them the indication of who it is that they're dealing with. But I think that's one of those things where they've got that inherent kind of hunch. As far as being able to look at him and say, hey, Bob, new face, like it. It's a good one. I don't think it works out that easily. I've never seen it or read about it anyway.
Well, but then we, you know, in The Doctor's Wife, you know, the Doctor talks about the Corsair and how he always had that one same tattoo in all of his regenerations. And then in the Silence in the Library, you know, River recognizes the Doctor. Like, it takes her a second, but she walks up to him. And she's like, oh, it's you. You know, it's like, that's the first time she's seen that face on him, but mm-hmm. she's able to pick him out. She's able to recognize that he is the Doctor.
I'm wondering if that's something different, though, because obviously, you know, we're not putting River in the same category, but she has some sort of a, you know, inherent knowledge, carnal or otherwise, you know, that gives her a bit of an advantage in being able to, I know my freaking husband when I see him.
Okay, fine. But what about, let's say, the Brigadier? Because towards the end of the Brigadier's time on the show, he was able to recognize the Doctor.
Not always.
Okay.
Remember, you know, from transitions from second to third, from third to fourth, yes. The reintroductions had to be made. And it was always this really ha-ha great moment when the Brig realizes that his friend has returned.
Yeah, but towards the end, after he had gotten to know the Doctor. Mm-hmm. So it goes
you,
to...
You just answered your own question.
Well, but what I'm saying, though, is, okay, someone who only has this one instance is able to pick up on that. People that live in that society who see regeneration all the time, don't you think that they would be able to make those kind of connections more readily because they're keyed to the things that tip it off?
I think that may be just a matter of some sort of an aura about them mm-hmm. that a good friend picks up on. But I don't know necessarily that means that all Time Lords are going to be able to look at another Time Lord from across the room and say, oh, yeah. That's, you know,
okay, yeah,
bag of donuts.
I'm not saying walk down the street and be like, hey, that's that, you know, see like a 6'7", 30-year-old guy, be like, hey, that's that old lady that I saw on the street yesterday. It's, mm-hmm. you know, I don't think that you're going to get that level of familiarity, but I do think that there's a point where, you know, they can recognize certain features and stuff. I think that they've got it figured out, at least to a functional level.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, I'm just wondering if, you know, maybe... an old friend or enemy of the Doctor somehow gets out of the time lock with a new face and he doesn't know who they are.
I think for the first few minutes that could probably work, but I would expect the Doctor to be able to pick up on that and say, oh, it's you, you know. But for the first little bit, I don't think that we're going to have that grand reveal at the very end. It's like, oh, you did not recognize me. I think that the Doctor would pick up on it. If it's someone that he actually did know.
Okay.
But it does make for some fun spitballing.
Well, then that leads us to now, and we've started to break into this, is to where we're kind of headed from here. We've had a couple discussions a few times as to whether or not we feel it's in the best interest of the show to bring the Time Lords back on a regular basis. Is the hunt for Gallifrey going to be an inherent part of Series 8, or is it something that's going to be the pursuit in Series 8 that never actually pays off because it's more, you know, the journey and not the destination? Or are we looking at something where, you know, it's going to return to what we had? You know, we've got a lot of indications that the show is going to be grabbing a lot of aspects of its classic roots, you know, from its dramatic writing to the pacing to these sorts of things. Does that also mean that we're going to get back to the idea of Time Lords being back full force and they're a bunch of pretentious pricks who every once in a while call on the Doctor to do something to drive the week's adventure?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that Moffat has proven at this point that he is a fan of the show. It's something he grew up on, and he has probably spent a fair amount of time pondering the same kind of stuff. So, I don't know. I think that he probably has a grasp on where things went wrong and why the Time Lords didn't need to be a part of the show in order for it to be successful. Mm. So, I can't believe I'm actually going to say this, but I trust Moffat to know where to draw the line. That hurt. That really hurt.
I'm really impressed that you were able to get that out without actually throwing up on yourself. That's good. You've come a long way.
You don't see vomit on an audio podcast.
No, but you can smell it. I do agree that because of his passion for the full scope of the show's history, he does genuinely have the best interests of the franchise in mind. But it's what he believes to be the best interest. You know, it's just like every fan is taking something different, something slightly different away from the show with every episode you watch, with every discussion that you have with another Whovian. You know, you're bringing something slightly different to the table. It's your perception of the Hooniverse, and everything you've been exposed to and everything that you hold near and dear. Some people latch on to companions, other people latch on to conflicts and resolutions. It's whatever you're passionate about. If he's the type that seems to be one that's inherently, that loves the intricacy of the story over the course of 50 years, and the fact that there are all of these interweaving aspects, which is why he gets such a kick out of throwing an episode out there, or one of these, you know, throwing an arc out there that grabs from, you know, 15 different points in the show's legacy and finds a way to blend it all together, you know, close a couple loopholes, you know, tie off a few loose threads, but introduce a few new things. He thrives on that. So if that's what he holds precious, I've got to think that with something as big as this, something that has been, since at least the Second Doctor, has been, you know, this recurrent aspect, you know, this is the governing body. These are the, you know, the guys behind the wall, that he's going to treat it with a degree of, I guess reusability is not the same, is not exactly where I'm headed here, but he wants this to be something that he can continue, or anybody that follows him can use to continue that, leaving those doors open. Close one door, open another, so the script continues to be this constantly changing bit of interest. He's definitely not going to paint the script into any corners.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's not going to bring them back so that it's just, you know, forget everything we've talked about since 2005. It was a nice story. It was sad. We wept. Boo-hoo. Time lock. It's all over. You know, it's definitely going to have more to it. But I don't know that he's necessarily going to, he's not going to tee up something as big as this and then just let it go.
Right. Yeah, and I think that that's what it is it's, we have to think that he has a master plan for all of this. I don't think it was just, I need something big for this 50th anniversary. Let's bring back the Time Lords. Okay, now what do I do with it? It's
put them back in the box. Yeah. It's too big. It's too big.
I mean, for all the crap that we give him, he does like to think big. He does like to think through things. He might not start from the finish and work his way backwards, but he does think beyond the one step that's in front of him.
Sure.
Right.
If anything, he usually has step one and step three figured out.
Yeah, it's step two that he has a problem with.
Yeah, step one, underpants. Step three, world domination.
Yeah, there's some the slight little thing there that gets lost, but I don't know. It'll be exciting though, and I'm hoping that it gets drawn out a little bit longer than the whole, whether or not the Doctor understands who Clara is thing. Because I was really hoping that we were going to get like 4 or 5 episodes of them like talking and little hints being dropped, and then finally him being like, "Oh, you're a souffle girl," you know. I wanted that to be drawn out more, and I'm hoping that that's what happens with the Time Lords. I'm hoping that it does become an arc, that it is something that stretches out, and he doesn't figure out in episode 1, oh, no, they can't come back, or, oh, hey, this is how I'm going to do it.
Yeah, I think Moffat knows that he needs an arc to carry through his season after the fan response to 7B, so I can't imagine he's going to resolve it quickly.
Here's hoping. Okay.
Well, that's if any indication from all of the discussion with producers, with cast, with everyone on the inside right now, as far as where the show is changing in terms of the nature of the show, maybe not necessarily the script of the show, but the nature of the show as far as those changes, this can give us the opportunity to start to get some of that back. The idea of recognizing the value of the long game and being able to let those heavy moments hang rather than saying, you know, all right, comedy, love, action sequence, comedy, love, action sequence, comedy, yeah, love, action, and just drill through it to the point where the scripts suffer beyond, you know, the episode of the week.
Right. Well, it's definitely exciting to think about. But
that gets us into what we wanted to discuss for news.
Yes, it does. So what's our first news story here?
The show has been canceled.
Oh, well, that makes things easier for next week.
So next week on Legends of S.H.I.E.L.D., we'll be discussing... I figure, should we leave the kind of spoilerifery to the end there? Or do we want to get this out of the way?
Let's leave that one for the end for now.
Okay, fair enough. Well, then, obviously, most of the new stuff that's been coming up right now has been people talking about the fact that the tour is underway.
Yes, great, it is. You know,
start in Wales, hit London. I forget where it is now.
Seoul, Korea, and I think they're in Australia now.
Working their way around. They'll spin through New York. It'll be great. But it seems to be, at this point, we're not really getting anything newsworthy out of it. It's just a lot of photo ops and that sort. And a peek into Jenna Coleman's phone.
Yeah, but that's another thing, is Jenna Coleman is now on Twitter. This is... I don't know if her account has been verified yet, but she is. I mean, there have been enough things pop up on there that kind of proves that it's her kind of thing. Either that or a very well done fake account.
Which has yet to fully exploit the power that it wields.
But yeah, if you want to follow Jenna Coleman on Twitter, it's @Jenna_Coleman_.
Yes.
So,
because that extra underscore is there for quality.
Exactly. No, but I mean, like we said, you know, it's a lot of pictures of, hey, here's the TARDIS in this place, and here we are standing in, you know, new place here. And so, yeah, fun times, but.
So, but the as all of this has been going on, something that kind of slipped under the radar for a lot of folks was something that a few of our listeners brought to my attention around the same time that I found it too, and we've all been kind of enjoying it. I've been watching this particular clip. It's more that's getting us into the beginning of Series 8, and it was actually handed over to us from the guys over at Tor.com or Tor.com, however you want to refer to it. But they've looked into what they're referring to as Into the Dalek.
And this one looks so great. I love it.
Yeah. So this is sort of it's a peek into the second episode. Mm-hmm. So we'll get through some of the chaos that's going to be the first full post-regeneration episode that's going to be, you know, taking place in Yorkshire with the Paternoster gang and everything. So now we're back to modern point, you know, present day, Doctor and Jenna having some of their deeper discussions. So this, as far as everything that I've been hearing from producers and directors, things saying that we're getting back to the dramatic roots and origins of the show, the fact that this was a science fiction drama and it was classified by the BBC categorization as a dramatic program. So that means they're shooting the scenes, cutting the scenes, and writing the scenes so that they're meant to be a little weightier, you know. So it is going to be a little bit more dialogue driven, but that's for some of us, I mean, myself included, by all accounts, are really waiting to get these introspective moments. You know, this is where the clips that you've been seeing in the official trailers that are, you know, them sitting on the steps of the console room and the doctor asking, am I a good man? And she replies, I don't know. Mm-hmm. That this is where it comes from. But you get to see that extended a little farther, and it's awesome.
Yeah, it's just exciting seeing this. And I mean, seeing the doctor's interaction with normal people and some of the lines that he gives, and it's so great. I love it. Because you start to see how he's actually going to be interacting with people, and it's everything I hoped it would be.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about, people were saying, you know, they love seeing how each doctor responds to a Dalek the first time he comes up against them. You know, mm-hmm. Think about, you know, what Eccleston, obviously, in Dalek, and his response to it, or Tennant's first reaction to a Dalek on site. Here you've got Capaldi's doctor coming up and seeing one, and he's so, it's almost like he's eager to roll his sleeves up and start dealing with it, because, you know, they've got a captive Dalek that apparently has some sort of a defect,
yeah,
that renders it to have a sense of morals. It's an outcast or a deviation from the rest of its race. And the doctor refers to it saying, it's a Dalek so damaged, it's turned good. You know, how could I possibly resist getting, elbow deep in this thing? So,
and I love the way he phrases it, too. He says, morality as malfunction. There's so much great in this, and I can't wait to see it. And thankfully, we're only 2 weeks out now, or less than 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. So, I think just in some of the little glimpses that you see here, once he kind of gets a little firmer footing underneath him, you get to see some glimpses of the kind of persona that he's going to be bringing to the character for the near future. And it really does have it's a persona that involves a little bit more of an analytical and critical slant on things. It does definitely have shades of that righteousness that we used to get from Third Doctor or such, where it was just a matter of, don't ask me stupid questions. I have work to do. You know, get out of, you know, lead follower, get out of my way. I've got right. The things. I'm on the clock here. So it's great to see that aspect from him. But it's still, even though he's being a bit spiky, it's still humorous. It's still kind of endearing because of just something that Capaldi brings to the character that just makes you accept it and enjoy it.
Right.
So I'm totally psyched about this.
Yeah, absolutely. Then some other stuff that we've got coming up. Moffat went, obviously that time of the week for him to say something again. He started talking about how we are probably going to be getting more online prequels and minisodes.
This is a trend it has to happen.
Yeah.
It has to happen. They learned, as he said, he was talking to SFX magazine, and he said, when they did the Pond Life series, you had an audience of over 6 million people looking to see each little dippy segment of just seeing the doctor pushing a vacuum cleaner around. You have to start to recognize that this is more than just, guys, we've already got this set built, and we spent a mint on the costumes and the props and everything, and everybody's here. They're still in makeup. Let's write some stupid little, coda to fit on the end of this thing. But I think they're starting to definitely recognize that there's more storytelling to be done.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, this is just exciting, though, because this is what we've been begging for, and hopefully, judging by the picture that they used on the thing, we might get more of the old Doctors too, especially 8th. But that's just pipe dreams at this point. But the fact that they're looking at this and saying this is a valid part of the show and this is something that we need to be putting out is exciting, because I mean, that's moving forward, that's progress. Mm-hmm. So it's fun stuff. But Oh, and then some minor news that we've got coming up. The BBC America Doctor Who Takeover Week what is this that we've got going on here?
Well, I mean, obviously they're just going to start kind of ramping up the degree of programming.
Lots of reruns.
Tons of reruns. But it's what they choose to rerun that's kind of interesting. There will be a couple of new things added to the mix leading up to Saturday afternoon when they start doing the, you know, the pre-show airing and, you know, Chris Hardwick all up in your face and such. But they've got a couple of sequences that they'll be adding, you know, like the what they're calling Doctor Who the Ultimate Companion, which kind of smells to us like a clip show.
Kind of.
Yeah.
And then the Real History of Science Fiction, which is not to be confused with Brian Cox's Science of Doctor Who. That's a different series entirely, right. Or a different a broadcast entirely. But then by the time you get to the Saturday proper, they're going to be from midnight onward, midnight Friday up through 6 or 7 o'clock that day, Saturday, they're going to be running a bunch of specials, and then they're going to run Series 7 in its entirety up through. So
lots of stuff to rewatch.
Sure.
But, and then some other news that we've got. The folks over at Gallifrey 1 have released two chunks of guests that they're going to be having come February. And, I mean, there's some big names on here so far. I mean, we've got Eve Miles, obviously Gwen Cooper from Torchwood, Neve McIntosh, better known as Vastra, Janet Fielding, Tegan. We've got Sophie Aldred, everyone knows as Ace, Fraser Hines. So we've got him coming back.
So you've got Jamie, Zoe, you've got a huge chunk of Torchwood. Mark Shepard's going to be there. So yeah, how can you grow? And he is phenomenal on a panel.
And I mean, seriously, Mark Shepard at this point, he's like the prince of geekdom. He's like one step below Nathan Fillion. Yeah. You put any kind of show out there and he's on it. He's at least got a guest spot. So, yeah.
And a large swath of past and present directors and writers as well.
Right.
So some of the panels that have to do with the writing are going to be just as fascinating as seeing the star factor. Because then you're going to be able to get into the actual workings and the cogs and gears behind where they're headed with the show and why they've made some of the decisions about how they've gotten to this point, which I think I'm going to be personally really interested in hearing what they have to say.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, the frustrating thing is that, Kira, I know you and I are going to have to, like, just take a look at the schedule and divide it right down the middle and compare notes at the end of the day because there's so much. And this is only...
I feel so bad for you two.
It sucks.
Such work, I swear. No, but I mean, this is only like the second block of guests that they've announced. It's not even like we're still, what, 6 months out at this point?
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Still waiting for flights to go down. LA used to be such an inexpensive city to fly into. What the hell happened?
Things cost more.
This sucks. Thanks, Obama.
Oh, all right. So are we ready to talk about the spoilery bits?
Yeah, sorry. Let's do this.
If you absolutely don't want anything, go ahead, sign off now. We'll talk to you next week. But we're not getting too seriously spoilery. But
it's actually just kind of, you know, potentially revisiting some possibly spoilery stuff that we talked about months ago that has now been either confirmed or denied.
Right. So let's see. This is the how do we want to get into this first?
Well, it was an article that had been pulled together or sort of a series of recaps on official statements that had come from both Moffat and Capaldi regarding aspects of the show that are the fans have been really rabid about wanting to hear about. From the mundane to the serious, you know, the little things like, you know, is he going to keep his accent? You know, why is he? You know, why is there such a stark costume change? You know, and so forth. So we've discussed some of these. You know, why? You know, is there going to be any more of this flirting thing, or is that kind of done with? So we've discussed some of those along the way. But I think the things that are really kind of weighing on us is we want to know what's happened with the whole Master return. Because Sylvester McCoy had put a kind of a cloudy tweet out there a few months ago that led everybody to believe that there was going to be a Return of the Master with a different actor portraying the role. And kind of went on and on. So Moffat has kind of, as officially as he will allow himself to, has put the kibosh on that.
Right. So, I mean, there's just some information in here about the different different questions that have been asked and that kind of thing. So, I mean, like we said, nothing too overtly spoilery, but, you know, it's there's information that you might not want to know, but
yeah, nothing too bad. So you can determine, I mean, if you want to know, you know, what the story is or what the justifications are as to, you know, why it is that they're going to be, you know, slowing the pace down on the show, what the official word is as to why they're changing the tone of the show, or why they claim that you're going to be able to recognize a change in the tone, or why it is that the Doctor's now suddenly going to have a Scottish accent where they've always even taken actors who weren't British to begin with, why they asked Tennant to change his accent, but they're not asking Capaldi to change his, and that sort of thing. Or what's the story with the Master? You know, we'll put that article out there and let you kind of take that apart.
Yeah, it'll be there. So, all right. But next week, we've got one more week before the show starts. So next week, we're going to be taking a look at the almost, I want to say, formula of the first appearances of each Doctor's episodes. You know, what kind of stuff we've gotten before, what are old standbys, what kind of stuff can we be looking for in the first episode?
So, this is sort of a pattern analysis.
Right. So just, you know, as we go through each one and say, okay, you know, this Doctor got this Doctor got the same thing. It's, you know, just see what we're in store for and just basically our best guesses as to what kind of episode we're looking at.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, figure, you know, you're taking into account things like, you know, does he have a support system in place, or is he freewheeling it? Has he been traveling solo prior to this, or has he had, you know, one or multiple companions prior? Are those companions carrying over? Is he in a familiar place and time, or did his regeneration and first appearance happen in a completely new location where he's a stranger in a strange land? And all those kind of aspects.
Does this mean I need to watch the 96 movie again?
Yep.
Yep.
Suck it up, Buttercup. Next time, take notes.
All right. Well, this has been episode 98 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, yeah, she's my care. She cares, so I don't have to.
And this is Gear saying, one does not make all, therefore you can be a dick, and the rest of us can be okay.
And this is Haley saying, I've heard you talk about your people like they're wonderful.
We'll see you guys next week.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows by calling 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1477 to leave us a voicemail. You can head to GallifreyPublicRadio.com to leave comments on each episode. There you can also keep up to date on all the latest news and gossip, as well as what's going on in the community. Also make sure to head over to GunnaGeek.com to find out lots of other high-quality, geek-centric shows. Music by Beyond the Epilogue and Retcon Addict.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2014.